day in a world where life's unkind. We search for answers we can't find. You are safe here, take my hand, you're not alone. Today, when you're lost and so confused, just believe you can lose. Only selfless love can be a gift to anyone. We are one family. Let's raise our hands, let's raise our voice. Let's show the world we have just begun. As God's children, we are one. We are one family. Share the treasures in your heart. For the time is now, let Him show us how to come together, a brand new start. Only selfless love, like Jesus showed the world. Only selfless love, let the voice in your heart be heard.
Let's make it happen. Family Matters with me, Tony Rowland, beginning again. At our usual time, 10 o'clock on a Wednesday morning, bringing you the good news of family life. And our good news today is all about missionaries, and in particular about Oblate missionaries, and even more specifically about Father Frank McGrail, who is just celebrating 70 years as an Oblate. So I'm big into promoting the elderly and the wisdom of the elderly at this particular time in my life. But our thoughts for the day are not about that. Our thoughts for the day, based on the gospel of today, are about legitimate punishment. And I think that's something that all of us, parents and priests and the Holy Father and saints and sinners, we all have to consider legitimate punishment. That's our thought for the day. Continuing a reflection and discussion on work across generations was interesting. The younger people were horrified at the thought of ever beating a servant. Now, hold on. I think I first need to share with you the scripture passage. The servant who knew his master's will and did not act according to his will shall receive a severe beating. But he who did not know and did what deserved a beating shall receive a light beating. And that's why I'm looking at legitimate punishment. Continuing so the reflection and discussion on work across generations highlighted some things. The younger people were horrified at the thought of ever beating a servant, never mind more or less severely. And yet, until quite recently, that was common practice, and a form of slavery still exists in some patriarchal relationships where men sometimes do beat their wives, and other circumstances may differ, sometimes in the context of trafficking or the treatment of foreigners by locals or by the authorities. The reality can leave much to be desired, as is a current reality right now with this campaign, this Dudula campaign against foreigners and maltreating foreigners in our country, preventing them from going to hospitals and schools and so on. But there are also occasions when workers, employees and employers are assaulted. So, the question to consider is, what is the legitimate and correct punishment for a particular offence? I shared with you the passage about the light beating and the heavy, severe beating if you knew the master's will, and the light beating if you didn't know the master's will. Well, Pope Francis says that public opinion is manifesting a growing opposition to the death penalty, even as a means of legitimate social defense, is a sign of hope. Rendering justice doesn't mean seeking punishment for its own sake, but ensuring that the basic purpose of all punishment is the rehabilitation of the offender. And that reflection is from Fratelli Tutti, Pope Francis's document on social friendship, where he writes a lot about abuse and punishment and war and the death penalty and subjects like that. In the Jubilee document, we are called to be tangible signs of hope for those of our brothers and sisters who experience hardships of any kind. I think of prisoners who, deprived of their freedom, daily feel the harshness of detention and its restrictions, a lack of affection, and in more than a few cases, lack of respect for their persons. I propose that in this Jubilee year, governments should undertake initiatives aimed at restoring hope, even with prisoners who are, after all, offenders. And that's his document on the Jubilee. So, accent pray, pray for the needs of families and our calling to become true missionary disciples. So that's our thought for the day. And we're going to have a little bit of music in between before we go on to our newsletter. Onward, Christian soldiers. Isn't that a lovely hymn? To start off our reflection on families on mission, the Obelisks, and the Missionary Church. Naturally, Mission Month and Mission Sunday on the Church's liturgical calendar led me to consider the role of missionaries in the Church, and of course how priests, together with brothers and sisters, led the way. Without a doubt, the mission was a part of the colonial trend and brought many men and women from Europe to Africa. The whole mission movement has been changing over the last 200 years since the Catholic Church began in South Africa. Enculturation in the 20th century focused on bringing Christ to Africa and Africa to Christ. As stated in the 1994 African Synod document, Ecclesia in Africa. This changing view brought missionary congregations from other African countries, but also a more universal vision of mission, together with the need for local vocations. So now we have local vocations, local men and women working in South Africa, but also going into other countries. So they're actually sharing the role of mission. Since the Second Vatican Council, the Church has begun also to focus more on the task of the laity, an awareness of the role of families for themselves, for one another, and for the Church as a whole is a growing need. It started, but still growing. On a personal note, I'd like to share a few thoughts here. Almost all of my time, from our arrival in South Africa in 1954, was spent in Johannesburg. My aunt had kindly arranged for my mother and us three daughters to be accommodated within the Rosebank Parish, where we briefly attended the parish, which was staffed by the Oblate Fathers. After that, we lived in Linden for a time and were members of St. Charles in Victory Park, again an oblate parish, which it still is. Later, in Chris and my ministry to the engaged and in parish work with my fam, we again encountered many oblate fathers, and I dare say we could mention names like Father Fidgen and Father Ron and Father Bugler. And those are some of the ones that really were ready to go the extra mile. Clearly, the oblate missionaries of Mary Immaculate were the backbone of the Diocese of Johannesburg for many years, in more affluent and also in poorer parishes of all the races, although most often separately. You used to have white parishes and black parishes and coloured parishes and Indian parishes, but now they are much more mixed. However, it didn't seem to me at the time as if this was missionary work in the sense of reaching out to poor missions, to the yet unconverted and the uncategorized. However, after many more years in my interview with Father Frank McGrail for my Family Matters program of today, my perception was corrected as he explained the history of the oblate presence in South Africa in the 19th century and particularly in the Johannesburg Diocese when it was formed. Father Frank himself came to South Africa in 1961 as a young oblate missionary priest and has recently celebrated 70 years as an oblate. Working in many aspects of the mission field as he incorporated his story into the greater history. His own work included parish ministry, teaching, education in general, clergy formation at pre-novitiate and later, and also in further formation. So, but our contact with him was in the area of parish family ministry in El Dorado Park, as we were developing this particular MAFAM project. Although, since Vatican II, oblate numbers have decreased, as is the case with many of the other older congregations. There are, apart from the old men, still young men willing to carry this area of the mission and dedicating their lives to the service of God's family and families. I find Father Frank's story enlightening and important too for younger generations to consider and to appreciate the contribution of men who have given their whole life and are now in their 80s and still active, still doing what they can in their particular communities. So I must say congratulations and thank you to Father Frank. So I need to mention that Family Matters, we call our newsletter Family Matters, but Family Matters is our radio program, which is broadcast weekly on Radio Veritas from 10 to 11 on Wednesdays. And remember that this is our newsletter, which is posted. So I'm reading what is posted to our subscribers. It's live streamed on Radio Veritas at co.za and can also be listened to on DSCV channel 870. And for those of you, including Father Frank, who I know is in class teaching at this time, we'll have to have a podcast so that he can listen in to his story that he shared with me and that we're going to be sharing right now. So there we go. Let's listen to this interview with Father Frank McGrail. Family Matters on Radio Veritas is the program that I present once a week. And every week I try to pick up on something that's relevant and contextual
And right now we are in Mission Month. So apart from trying to be contextual and relevant, of course, it also has to be family-centered. So that's really the focus of our little chat here. So good afternoon. Well, it's afternoon because it's afternoon. Father Frank McGrail, would you like to say something about yourself, or shall I tell the listeners what I know?
Well, there's not much to say, really, but...
Oh, I bet you there's lots to say. Wait till I start interrogating you, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. You know, I think that we first met when you were parish priest in El Dorado Park.
Probably, yes.
And how many years ago would that be?
Oh, that was...
At least 30 years ago.
Probably that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
The numbers and that just run out of my mind.
Well,
I'll tell you what. Let me just give you the background. I came to South Africa in 1961.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I came by boat.
Mm.
The Athlone Castle.
Okay.
From Southampton to Cape Town, and then I was 1 day and 2 nights on the train.
Mm-hmm.
To get to Johannesburg.
Mm-hmm.
And I was picked up on a Saturday morning by the provincial, Father Michael Doherty. He was a Scotsman. And that afternoon I was in Maryvale.
Wow, hey?
Yeah, just like that.
Just like that.
And then I was in Maryvale for 9 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. But now we need to fill in some of those details. You know, I also came to South Africa by boat in 1954. And we had, our ship was the Waterman, and we came from the Netherlands. And I can relate to the 1.5 days on the train.
Yeah.
But it was my mother, who was widowed, and 3 daughters who came from Cape Town to Joburg. And then we were also fortunate to be picked up by... my aunt who was here already, she was doing private nursing, and she arranged for us to stay with this man that she was nursing, and that was Rosebank.
Ah.
So we went to church in Rosebank, and I'm sure you know the priest who would have been in Rosebank in those days.
Father Davern, was it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I think it was Tony Bailey was there, and Kevin Bugler, and some
they
of those.
Were there afterwards.
That yes. That well, those are the ones I remember at Rosebank. But you know, I think we just need to say that, of course, we're talking about the oblates.
Yes.
The missionary oblates of Mary Immaculate. Mm. Yes. And you know, for a long time I didn't realize that the oblates were a missionary congregation.
Yes, yes. Well, initially, the mission was when we were founded in Provence.
In France,
south of France, yeah, for preaching missions.
Okay.
Yeah, that was towards the end of the period of Napoleon. So, preaching missions, and especially through the use of Provençal rather than French, because they were preaching to the poor in the rural areas.
Okay.
And of course, most of them wouldn't have been fluent in French, but Provençal would have been.
Mm-hmm.
And the oblates were preaching in Provençal.
Mm-hmm. Did you have to learn that language too?
No. That was
like 100 years earlier.
We were kind of found. We began around about 1816, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we started beginning to get together. 1818, the first group got together.
Yeah, and you also said that you know the mission was really to the poor.
Yes.
And that also is something that I came across when I was reading up a little bit about the oblates, that your mission is really focused on the poor.
That was the main focus.
Right.
But there was a tendency as things developed, to see the need, whatever need came up.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, and it took quite a while, we began to, our first mission outside was in Canada.
Outside of France.
Outside of France.
Before the UK.
I'm not quite sure now, you know, the sequence, but certainly our first, we during de Mazenod's time, de Mazenod was the founder, or de Mazenod probably. The three big missions were Canada, Ceylon, and South Africa, in that order. And we were just responding to needs. And the real expansion of the order came when we took on foreign missions. Because France in those days was one of the leading missionary countries.
Right.
For sending missionaries, the French.
Yes. Because the propagation of the faith that we are kind of commemorating around Mission Month, that also originated in France, didn't it?
No, the propaganda fide was, well, that was Italian. That was an attempt by the church to retake power or control over missionary activities. Before that, round at the time of the Reformation afterwards, the missionary activity was done through the King of Spain and the King of Portugal. In Portuguese, it was the Padroado, or Patronato in Spanish. So the church gave the job of evangelization to the big colonizing powers, the Spanish to the west and the Portuguese to the east. And the development of the propaganda fide was an attempt by the church then to turn the control of the missions as part of the Vatican dicastery. Well, we call them dicasteries now. And the propaganda fide is the main one that controls missionary activity.
Okay, so then in South Africa, because the Catholic Church was only, I believe, permitted to minister in South Africa about 200 and something years ago?
Yeah. You see, during the time of the Dutch East India Company, right, which was very Calvinist, Catholics were not welcome at the Cape. Well, the Cape was a stopping centre because of the spice trades with the East. The East was really the important, for the spices. And that was, the Dutch were traders. I mean, that was their calling. So the Catholic Church was not really present at the Cape. Then during the Napoleonic Wars, to cut a long story short, the British took over the Cape. But they weren't any more favorably, they didn't look particularly favorably upon Catholics. But in the end, because they were soldiers, they were Germans, they were Irish, the first bishop in Cape Town, was Bishop Griffiths, I think, was brought out as a chaplain to Catholics. That was the So we were the Catholic Church in South Africa was very much late on the scene.
Yeah, because they had all these other missionary societies.
The missionary site, well, yeah, the London Missionary Society. So the work in South Africa at the beginning of the 19th century was largely Protestant. But there were there was a bishop at Cape Town and there was a bishop at Port Elizabeth. And their job basically was to look after the Catholics. It wasn't to convert or to build a church up. And they decided that there was a need for a missionary congregation to take over the area of Port Natal, which had just been taken from the Boers. There had been a Boer Republic for a very short while. The British took it over, right? And during that time, the bishop of in Port Elizabeth decided, sent a bishop, sent a priest, a Father Murphy, funny enough, to Natal, well, to Port Natal, to find out what was happening. He identified Catholics, and the idea was to bring out a religious order that would look after the Catholics there and begin the evangelization of the African people.
As well, okay? Yeah. Well, yeah, so they moved away from just caring for the Catholics.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I believe that for quite a long time, congregations didn't really welcome local vocations.
Actually, no. The question of local vocations is a much later thing.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, you might have heard that
from a very
No. there was a very, I think it was Bishop Sheedy or Sheehan, who actually only wanted Irish priests.
Oh.
But that was Port Elizabeth.
Yes, I know. Yeah, I heard that in Port Elizabeth.
Now, this is something completely different.
Okay.
In those days, the idea of local vocations was not the immediate idea.
Yeah, yeah. So now the Oblates came to... Were they the
we were then the first... Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, actually, propaganda, they tried the Jesuits, no luck. They tried the Holy Ghost Fathers, who were one of the main African in another part of Africa.
Yes.
And then they finally landed on us.
Okay.
And in the beginning of the 1850s, that's when the first Oblates came to Natal. Okay. But then they were responsible for the entire interior.
Yeah.
Right up to the Boer, to the Portuguese possessions, and right across to the Boer republics. You know, the Orange Free State, the Orange River Free State, and the Transvaal republics, and that area.
Right.
But the beginning of the evangelization was with the Zulu peoples along the coasts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that still is a important part of the Oblate mission, isn't it?
Yes, except that the first missionaries were not very successful. I suppose that they were French. The story is that a French encyclopedia called the Oblates un type de Jésuite de la campagne.
Country
Jesuits.
Okay.
And probably in the beginning, they kind of dealt with the Zulus as they would with the people in Provence and in France.
Yeah.
And they didn't go across. It didn't work too well.
Mm-hmm.
It the first attempts at missionary work were unsuccessful.
Yeah, but didn't those who became the Marian Hill what was the original?
They
had the same problem.
You're jumping ahead there. You're jumping ahead. That came much later.
Okay.
The Oblates eventually made contact with the Basutu.
Yes.
And then, but a priest like Father Gerard had learned the lesson.
Mm-hmm.
So his approach to the Basutu was very different.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, he got on well with Moshweshwe, who was the king.
Yeah.
Right? And then he introduced a very long catechumenate. You see, the idea of the missionaries first, you went in, you preached, and you baptized.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But, it's not very good missiology. So they came in, and eventually Father Gerard established a very sound church in Moshweshwe's kingdom.
Later on,
the Bishop of Port Elizabeth went to Austria because his idea was bring monks. And like the medieval times, right, you bring out monasteries, right, and these monasteries would be centers of development, farming, and evangelization.
Yeah.
It didn't work too well. He gave them very bad land. Abbot Fanner was his name. This was the 1880s right?
Mm.
And they didn't stay in Port Elizabeth. They went to Natal.
Mm. Mm.
And Bishop Dalal, who was the oblate bishop there, he welcomed them. And then they established themselves a monastery, a Trappist monastery.
Mm, a Trappist.
They were Trappists.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
They established a Trappist monastery in what's now Marion Hill.
Mm.
In fact, he came with the wagons, right? And he got stopped at the hill, and Mary Ann, and the mother of Mary Ann.
Mm.
So they were Germans,
mm.
right? They were Germans.
Mm.
And they established a Trappist monastery.
Mm.
But because they were so involved in missionary work, the Trappists were unhappy with them as Trappists because they were more involved in missionary activities and building all these mission stations.
Mm.
So to cut a long story short, the Trappists... They decided to give them the option. Mm. Either they would remain Trappists, or if they wanted, they could leave and become diocesan priests, or they could establish a new missionary.
Yeah, yeah.
So they ceased to be Trappists, and they changed into a modern congregation, missionary congregation.
Of Marion Hillers,
And they're called Marion Hill.
Yeah, yeah. But the oblates were able to maintain their kind of vision, were they?
Yes, slowly but surely, yes. Uh-huh. They became one of the main evangelizers, right?
Uh-huh. In the whole country?
Well, no, mainly in the area of Natal.
Uh-huh.
And then when the diamond fields opened up, the oblates moved there.
Mm.
And then, of course, when the gold mines moved up, the oblates likewise moved up too. That's how the spreading came.
Right.
Because there was really nothing much in South Africa before that.
Yeah.
Nobody was interested. The only cash crop they had was sheep and wool. But once the diamonds were discovered, once the gold was discovered, that's when the area blossomed.
Mm. Yeah. But then what about Lesotho then?
That continued.
Yes. But I mean, what do they have to offer other than people? Do they have sheep and... Yeah.
No, it was a settled community created by Moshweshwe.
Yeah.
And the oblates managed to have an inroad into them. And
because he himself, Moshweshwe, was converted, wasn't he?
No, not.
But he certainly supported.
He supported them. But about 30 years before, he also had Protestant missionaries, French Protestant missionaries.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So when the oblates came, there were already French missionaries there, but they were French Calvinists.
Okay. And you think it made that much difference?
It probably did. The thing was that the people were already familiar with Christianity.
Mm.
They weren't familiar with Catholicism, but they were familiar with Christianity.
Yeah.
And then Gerard was quite a good linguist, actually. But he then came with what you might call a more people-orientated missionary style. And it grew from there.
Mm. Yeah, and it's still a big center for the oblates, isn't it? I mean, the university.
Yeah.
Is it a seminary or is it a university?
There's a university there. It was a university.
Mm-hmm.
And that was put up by the South African bishops.
Oh.
The university. Oh. Well, they had a seminary there, obviously, with schools and minor seminaries,
Yeah.
The bishops wanted to create a Catholic university, which was outside the South African segregation. So in Lesotho, yeah, yeah. It was kind of independent.
So now in 1961, what was the time of Joseph Gerard? When did he
die?
He
died in 1914.
14?
14, yeah.
Oh, as long ago as that, yeah. Hey? Yeah. So, then, I mean, you would not have, obviously wouldn't have known him, no.
No, no.
No, because you're too young for that. I didn't actually know his timing.
No, the danger is you start running the ages together, right?
You do.
This is way back.
Yeah.
And a lot of the missionaries, two Oblate missionaries, came from Quebec. They were French Canadians.
But now, where are you actually from?
Well, my parents are Irish, but I was born in England.
Mm-hmm.
My contact with the Oblates were two uncles.
Uh-huh.
My mother's oldest brother was an Oblate priest,
mm-hmm.
who spent about 10 years in Ceylon.
Oh, okay.
And then came back and was in Ireland after that.
Yeah.
And my mother's youngest brother was an Oblate brother. So it was a kind of a family thing.
So now you were saying that you've been an Oblate for 70 years.
Yes.
But that was when you would have joined the congregation, not when you were ordained.
No.
Or how does it work?
It works like this. First of all, you go to the novitiate.
Mm.
Right? In those days, we didn't have the pre-novitiate we have now. You went straight into the school, into the novitiate.
Uh-huh.
I was quite young at the time. Going into the novitiate, after a year in the novitiate, you make your vows for 1 year.
Mm.
And you count it from then.
Okay, yeah.
So in those days, you made vows for a year, renewed it, and then, after 3 years, you made final vows.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we get our crucifix,
mm-hmm.
that distinctive crucifix we have. And then in 61, then I came to South Africa.
Was that a choice or were you sent? No.
Holy obedience.
Holy, yeah. Did you say, or who was it? It was you that said you have an extra vow of perseverance.
Yes, that. We have four vows: poverty, chastity, obedience, and perseverance.
Mm-hmm.
And the perseverance is a kind of a canonical. It's a canonical thing, because you're making a vow in favor of a third person, in favor of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 19th century, particularly, there was always a dispute whether a bishop could dispense you from vows. But he couldn't dispense you from a vow in favor of a third person. That had to go to the Vatican. Mm-hmm. But in 1826, we were given the status of a pontifically recognized congregation.
Yeah. Right.
So we fall under the Pope rather than under a bishop.
Okay. So that's the situation here in South Africa.
Well, it's the situation for the Oblates, wherever we are.
Yes, but I mean, you have a provincial, and he answers to the Pope,
he answers to the Superior General,
uh-huh.
who's in Rome.
Who's in Rome.
We have a general house in Rome,
mm-hmm.
right, and the Superior General mm-hmm. and his council,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the Oblate world is divided up into provinces.
Mm-hmm. How many Oblates would there be worldwide?
At the moment, we're about maybe 3,700, give or take.
Mm-hmm.
But when I joined, we were over 7,000. In the 1960s, we were over 7,000. But like all religious orders, congregations, our numbers have gone down mm-hmm. over the past...
Well, of course, in one sense, gone down with existing men and brothers, presumably, leaving, or otherwise not new vocations.
In the 60s and 70s, that was the time when a lot of people left.
Mm.
But, it continued. But the thing is, we exist in about 62 different countries.
Sure.
Okay. So yeah. While the numbers might be going down in one place, they're going up in another.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. Africa is doing very well. Europe, America, not very well.
Yeah.
But Africa and Asia. Mm. India, for instance, we're doing well. Vietnam, we're doing quite well in Vietnam. And so on. So where the numbers are going down in one place, they're actually going up. Now. In South Africa, we're probably... we're not really expanding at a great rate, but we're managing to hold our own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That I need to know a little bit more about you. What were the highlights of your ministry?
It's hard to say. For 9 years, I was at Maryvale Parish.
Mm.
Then I was moved to St. Benedict's College for another 9 years.
Yeah. Right? And then you would, that was a school, a boys' school.
It was a boys' school,
yes.
Then I was given the job of starting off a new thing called a pre-novitiate.
Mm-hmm.
It was realized that people were not ready to come off the street into a novitiate.
Mm.
They needed a time of conditioning, if you like. Mm. Right?
Like a bridging course.
A kind of a bridging thing.
Yeah.
And we worked out that maybe 2 years where a person needed to change their lives.
Mm.
You see, the 1960s, as you know, were a year of everything went out the window. You know, the 1960s, freedom, everything else.
Mm.
A lot of the discipline of the old, of old times went.
Mm.
And so people were growing up in a very almost pagan kind of society, to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
Outwardly Christian, perhaps, but so many changes. And so that a person needed a time to change attitudes, values, whatever. And that was the pre-novitiate. And I was given the job of starting, we had one in Natal, I was given the job of starting one in the Transvaal, or as it was the Transvaal then.
Yeah.
So I was 5.5 years at the location in Mansfield, near Krugersdorp, where we were developing the pre-novitiate.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah. So when I met you, or Chris and I met you in El Dorado Park, that was
much later. About 1988, my mother was very ill. I'm an only child, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
My mother was very ill. She was on her own. Mm. And I was given time off to go to England.
Mm.
And it was in 1988. So I went to England. She was only lasted for about 4 months. And then she died. But I stayed in England for another 2 years and was able to do some studies at London University.
Mm-hmm.
At the School of Oriental and African Studies,
which
was quite, that was quite something. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I came back, the provincial sent me back to St. Benedict's.
Mm-hmm.
I was there for 4 years.
Okay.
So, and then about 1992, 1992, I went to El Dorado Park,
mm-hmm.
as the parish priest.
As a parish priest.
That was 30 years after my ordination, I became a parish priest.
Became a parish priest. But then in Maryvale, you would have been a parish priest.
I was assistant. I was about the fourth curate there.
Okay.
I was very low down on the list.
Yeah, because in El Dorado Park...
Then I was there for 13 years.
Wow, hey. Mm. Yeah. Yeah. But that parish already existed.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other parish in El Dorado, St. Catherine of
Siena? No, there's one parish.
Is it only one parish and two churches?
There were two churches, And during the time there,
yeah.
the area across the road, across the Golden Highway, a huge squatter camp spread up.
I know.
It's the so eventually, well, of course, we were responsible for that,
yeah.
And we ended up with the help of Victory Park, Father Fidgen in Victory Park, as a millennium project.
Oh.
We put up a chapel in Freedom Park,
Freedom Park,
which is now a thriving little parish.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah, yeah.
But sure. El Dorado itself,
yeah.
We've got St. Catherine's,
yeah.
And then we've got the new church, which was St.
Eugene,
right? But yeah. That's one parish.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. And then, you know, it's a difficult area to work in, isn't it?
It was. Yeah. I must say, I love the people. They were lovely people.
Yeah.
But we had a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And the gangs, drugs, whatever.
And those problems just never seem to be solved, isn't it?
Well, until South Africa begins to get a better employment, because the point is when we have an unemployment rate of about 40%,
yeah.
Sure, not going to solve social problems.
That's right, yeah.
But I really felt El Dorado was a very good parish in many ways, and they were very good men, right?
Mm.
And I remember Wally Adams.
He's still there, isn't he?
Well, he's still there.
Yeah.
But he actually was training to be a deacon, right?
Mm.
And I had a very good man on the finance committee, Vincent Moffat, right?
Mm.
And that's when there was already money there, and we continued with the collection, and that's when we built St. Catherine, St. Eugene's.
Okay, I got it the other way around, yeah. And now, after your 70 years of being an oblate, they're still expecting you to do something, are they?
Not really, but the point is, there's a need just to have an extra man in the novitiate, and I'm happy to be there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have to, you know, I can describe myself as the old guy in the novitiate. That's really
yeah.
what I am.
And I should be the old girl in my little home here, in a retirement village.
Yeah.
Also still active in many ways. Hey? Now, Father Frank, that was such an interesting story. A lot about the, you know, the mission of the oblates. I'm very pleased that, you know, that you talked about that as well. And thank you for your contribution to the church in South Africa. Southern Africa, maybe we should say.
Yeah, well, let's hope. I remember somebody saying, the main thing is not to do too much damage.
Oh.
To reduce the amount of damage we do rather than perform great work.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I sometimes describe myself as a mad prophet. Well, maybe that's just my way of looking at myself. Hey, but thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And God bless you. And thanks for taking the trouble to come here and share with me.
Right.
God bless.
Thank you.
Thank you. Now, listening to that beautiful choral version, on the CD cover, it said, "Ye Servants of God." But I know that tune only as "O Praise Ye the Lord." But I wanted to use the concept of the servant of God, which is really what priests, religious,
It is their calling to praise God, but also to be the servants of God. And I think Pope Francis and other popes have already said that many times, that the priest is not somebody to control, but is meant to be a servant of the servants of God. Now, the Pope is the servant of the servants of God, and the priests are the servants of God, but they're also the servants of the people. And that's one aspect that I find quite challenging in maybe the way missionaries started off, that they were going into a country where people didn't know Jesus. They might have known God in their own way, but they didn't know about Jesus. And as I said earlier on, the role of the missionaries has become to bring Christ to Africa and Africa to Christ. So it's a complicated one. It's not just a missionary coming from Europe and telling uncatechized, un-Christianized people about God. It's about them learning to listen to what the people's own beliefs are, how they perceive God, and that's something that we have been struggling with. I was at this inter-religious conference on, in fact, the document Nostra Aetate was written at the end of the Second Vatican Council, and it was looking into our relationship. Anyway, so check it out. Yes, Nostra Aetate, the relationship between other religions, between Hindus and Buddhists and Jews, and the section we were looking at yesterday was between Muslims and Catholics. A particular section in that document focuses specifically on that. And so it's all very well for us to bring a faith belief system, if you like. And I think the Muslims maybe are worse than we are on that, because they appear to be more engaged in imposing their belief on the people that they are coming to. Whereas we Catholics have changed our missionary focus quite a bit to become better listeners, which is what Pope Francis and Pope Leo are talking about, listening to how people understand their God. We teach them, we allow them to observe, we allow them to absorb our faith and to freely adopt our faith. And I think that's the current focus in missionary work. Okay, but you know, seeing that we were talking about Jews and Muslims and Catholics, I want to end our program with a song about Jerusalem, the holy city. And then I will sign off for today, having spent most of the morning here at Radio Veritas already. So let's have the holy city.
Jerusalem, Jerusalem, lift up your gates and see.